Okay, welcome everyone to a Tuesday afternoon here in America, and Tuesday evening in Europe and elsewhere, Wednesday morning in Australia, Japan. I'm Stephen Robertson. This is Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio, and also PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and SoFlo Radio out of Southern Florida. Thanks everyone, Annie, Angel Espino, and Bob, Robert, for all the other stations. I don't get to talk to him much, so I am foggy-headed today, and his name is escaping me. Wait a minute, I'll figure it out here in a second. I don't want to say Bob Wilson because it's not Bob Wilson. Bob Morris. Robert Morris from EPGN Radio. I am foggy-headed. Must have woke up three times last night. Got spotty sleep. And I got up early this morning and been trying to get all caffeinated up to get through the day. It is working a little bit, but not too much. And I don't want to have any more caffeine because I'll be up till 5 o'clock in the morning. Probably be up till 3 anyways. But I am going to continue on reading the Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. As I mentioned last week, I'm well more than halfway through. And I don't know. He has revealed some stuff that I didn't know, but he has revealed a lot of stuff that I did know. So, it depends. I may not get any more Bertrand Russell books, but if I do, I'll probably just read them on my own. And I did want to mention, before I forget, all of the stations are listener-supported, so please hit that donate button if you're able to. And if you want to. Hopefully I can get through this 2 hours without having any problems. As I mentioned, last week was the end of Chapter 6. Going into Chapter 7, Technique in the inanimate nature. Don't see that word too often, so I had to look at it again. Technique in inanimate nature. The greatest triumphs of Allied science so far have been in the realm of physics and chemistry. When people think of scientific technique, they think primarily of machines. It seems probable that in the near future, science will achieve equal triumphs in biological and physiological directions, and will ultimately acquire as much power to change men's minds as it already has power to deal with our inanimate environment. In the present chapter, however, I shall not be concerned with the biological applications of science, but with the more familiar and hackneyed theme of its applications in the realm of machinery. Most machines, in the narrower sense of that word, do not involve anything that deserves to be called science. Don't forget, this is 1937 or 38. I don't remember which one now that he did write this. So things are probably going to be a lot different than back in his time. Machines were, in origin, merely a means of causing inanimate material to go through a series of regular movements, which had hitherto been performed by the bodies and especially the fingers of human beings. This is particularly obvious in the case of spinning and weaving. Not very much science was involved in the invention of railways or in the early stages of steam navigation. Men were here utilizing forces that were by no means recondite in ways, which, though they astonished, ought not to have been astonishing. When we come to electricity, however, the matter is otherwise. A practical electrician has to develop a new type of common sense, of which the man ignorant of electricity is totally devoid. This new type of common sense consists entirely of knowledge discovered by means of science. A man whose days have been passed in a simple rural existence knows the kind of thing that a mad bull is likely to do. But however old and sagacious he may become, he will not know what an electric current is likely to do. One of the purposes of industrial technique has always been to substitute other forms of power for the power of human muscles. Animals depend completely upon their own muscles for securing the satisfaction of their wants, and primitive man, once one must suppose, shared that this dependence. Gradually, as men acquire more knowledge, they become increasingly able to command sources of power which left their own muscles unfatigued. Some genius in some forgotten antiquity invented the wheel, and some other genius induced the ox and the horse to make the wheel go round. It must have been a much more difficult job to tame the ox and the horse than it has proved to tame electricity. But the difficulty was one of patience, not of intelligence. Electricity, like a jinn in the Arabian Nights, is a patient servant to anyone who knows the right formula. The discovery of the formula is difficult, but the rest is easy. In the case of the ox and the horse, no great skill was required to see that their muscles could do more effectively the work that human muscles had previously done. But it must have been a long time before the ox and the horse became submissive to the will of their tamers. There are those who say that they were tamed because they were worshipped, and that the practical utilization of them came later, after the priests had completely domesticated them. This theory is inherently probable, since most all great advances have sprung originally from disinterested motives. Scientific discoveries have been made for their own sake, and not for their utilization. And a race of men without a disinterested love of knowledge would never have achieved our present scientific technique. Take, for example, the theory of electromagnetic waves, upon which the use of wireless depends. Wonder what they had back in 1937 that was wireless. Relevant scientific knowledge begins with Faraday, who first investigated experimentally the connection of the intervening medium with electric phenomena. Faraday was no mathematician, but his results were reduced as mathematical form by Clerk/Maxwell, who discovered the means of purely theoretical constructions that light consists of electromagnetic waves. The next stage of the proceedings was due to Hertz, who first artificially manufactured electromagnetic waves. What remained to be done was merely to invent apparatuses by which these waves could be produced with a commercial profit. This step, as everybody knows, was taken by Marconi, Faraday, and Maxwell, and Hertz. So far as can be discovered, never for a moment considered the possibility of a practical application of their investigations. Huh. No word about Tesla in here, as far as those other four men. Indeed, until the investigations were almost completed, it was impossible to foresee the uses of which they could be put. Even in cases where the purpose throughout has been practical, the solution of one has very often resulted from the solution of another, with which it had no apparent connection. Take, for example, the problem of flying. This has, at all times, exercised men's imaginations. Leonardo da Vinci devoted far more time to it than he did to painting. But men who misled, until our own day, by the notion that they must have a mechanism analogous to the wings of birds. It was only the discovery of the petrol engine and the development for the sake of motor cars that led to the solution of the problem of flying. And in the early stages of the petrol engine, it did not occur to anyone that it would prove capable of this application. One of the most difficult problems of modern technique is that the raw materials industry uses up as a continually increasing rate substances which have been stored throughout geological time in the Earth's crust and which are not being replaced in any usable form. One of the most flagrant instances is oil. The supply of oil in the world is limited, and the consumption of oil is continually and rapidly increasing. It will probably not be very long before the world's supply is practically exhausted, unless indeed the wars which will take place for its possession are sufficiently destructive to reduce the level of civilization to a point where oil will no longer be needed. Well, you know, I'm not going to say I could see into the man's heart, but he was very high up on the chain of knowledge. I believe for a long, long time they have known the fact that crude oil is an infinite source, not a finite source. It is a biological, and it does renew itself. It doesn't come from dinosaurs or fossils or anything like that. That's my belief. I know we've been lied to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and this is one of them lies, in my opinion. We may, I suppose, assume, if our civilization has not suffered a cataclysm, that some substitute for oil will be discovered, as oil becomes more expensive through rarity. But as this example shows, industrial technique can never become static and traditional, as agriculture technique did in former times. It will be permanently necessary to invent new processes and to find new sources of power, owing to the extraordinary rapidity of which we are consuming our terrestrial capital. There are, of course, some practical, inexhaustible sources of power, notable wind and water. The latter, however, even if fully utilized, would be very inadequate to the world's needs. The utilization of wind, owing to its irregularity, would require vast accumulators more free from leakage than any that can be manufactured, that can now be manufactured. The dependence upon natural products, which we have inherited from a simpler age, is likely to grow less with the progress of chemistry. It is probable that in a very near future, synthetic rubber will replace the rubber tree, and artificial silk has already replaced natural silk. Artificial woods can readily be manufactured through, though this is not yet a commercial proposition, but the exhaustion of the world's forest, which is eminent owing to the growth of newspapers, will soon make it necessary to employ other materials than wood pulp for the production of paper, unless indeed the habit of hearing the news on the wireless leads men to abandon the written word as a source for their daily sensation. One of the scientific possibilities of the future, which may have great importance, is the control of climate and artificial means. Imagine that. Control of the climate by artificial means. 1938. There are those who say that if a breakwater some 20 miles long were constructed to a suitable point on the eastern coast of Canada, it would completely transform the climate of southeast Canada and New England, since it would cause the cold current which now flows along their shores to sink to the bottom of the sea, leaving the surface to be replenished by warm water from the south. I do not vouch for the truth of this idea, but it serves to illustrate possibilities which may in the future be realized. To take another illustration, the greater part of the land between latitudes 30 degrees and 40 degrees has been gradually drying up and supports at present, in many regions, as much smaller population did 2,000 years ago. In Southern California, irrigation has transformed the desert into one of the most fertile regions of the world. There is no known means of irrigating the Sahara or the Gobi Desert, but perhaps the problem of rendering these regions fertile will not, in the end, prove beyond the resources of science. Modern technique has given man a sense of power which is rapidly altering his whole mentality. Until recent times, the physical environment was something which had to be accepted and made the best of. If the rainfall became insufficient to support life, the only alternatives were death or migration. Those who were strong in war adopted the latter, and those who were weak, the former. To the modern man, his physical environment is merely raw material, an opportunity for manipulation. It may be that God made the world, but that is no reason why we should not take it over. Read that again. It didn't really mix. It may be that God made the world, but that is no reason why we should not take it, not make it over. I knew I misread something there. This attitude, far more than any intellectual arguments, is proving inimical. I-N-I-M-I-C-A-L. Inimical. To traditional religion. Traditional religion embodied the idea of man's dependence upon God. This idea, while still nominally acknowledged, no longer has the hold of the imagination of the modern scientific industrialist that it had on the primitive peasant or fisherman, to whom droughts or storms might bring death. To the typical modern mind, nothing is interesting on account of what it is, but only on account of what it may be made to become. The important characteristics of things from this point of view are not their intrinsic qualities, but their uses. Everything is an instrument. If we ask what it is an instrument to, the answer will be that it is an instrument for the making of instruments, which will in turn make still more powerful instruments, and so on ad infinitum. Just spit that one out. Infinitum. In physical terms, this means that the love of power has thrust aside all the other impulses to make the complete human life. Love, parenthood, pleasure, and beauty are of less account to the modern industrialist than to the princely magnates of the past times. Manipulation and exploitation are the ruling passions of the typical scientific industrialist. The average man may not share his narrow concentration, but for that very reason, he fails to acquire a hold on the sources of power, and leaves the practical government of the world to the fanatics of mechanism. I think what he just said there was, us common men don't want to screw over the world, and the scientific industrialists do. Maybe I'm incorrect in my assessment there, but I don't think so. The power of producing changes in the world, which is possessed by the leaders of big businesses in the present age, far exceeds the power ever possessed by individuals in the past. They may not be as free to cut off heads as were Nero or Genghis Khan, but they can settle who shall starve and who shall become rich. They can divert the course of rivers and decree the fall of governments. All history shows that great power is intoxicating. Fortunately, the modern holders of power are not yet quite aware how much they could do if they chose. But when this knowledge dawns upon them, a new era of human tyranny is to be expected. He is right there. Absolutely. I see why he was used as one of the thinkers and philosophers of the elite. Chapter 8, Technique in Biology. I'll go through one paragraph and then take the first break, everyone. So, scientific technique has been applied by human beings to satisfy a number of diverse desires. At first, it was applied mainly to the production of clothing and to the transport of goods and human beings. With the telegraph, it acquired important functions in the rapid transmission of messages, making possible the modern newspaper and the centralization of government. A great deal of first-class scientific intelligence has found its chief effect in the increase of trivial amusement. The most fundamental of all human needs, namely food, was at first not much influenced by the Industrial Revolution. The growing up of the American Middle West by means of railways was the first great change in regard to food that was caused by scientific technique. Since that time, Canada and Argentine, he says Argentine, he doesn't say Argentina, Argentine, Argentine, India have become important sources of grain for European countries. The mobility of cereals, which we owe to railways and steamships, has removed the menace of famine, which hung over all medieval countries and which has, even in quite recent years, afflicted both Russia and China. This change, however important as it is, has not been due to the application of science to agriculture. In recent times, biological science has been found of growing importance in relation to the food supply. Another half paragraph here, I guess. Economists used to teach that modern technique could only cheapen manufactured articles, while food was to increase steadily in price as population increased. It did not, until recently, appear probable that the revolution in food production, as important as the revolution in the production of manufactured goods, might be brought about by the application of science. Nowadays, however, this seems far from improbable. Okay, mark my spot here, everyone, and take the first break. Sorry for the silence there. Had to get a pen that worked. I guess in about almost 7 minute break. Well, 4.5 minute break here, everyone, so be right back in a little bit. Oh, come and Okay. Welcome back, everyone. I hope everyone's enjoying this reading here. Hopefully he will start to get into some more things that we know and expose some more lies. Oops. There has not been, in relation to agriculture, any one resounding and revolutionary invention analogous to the introduction of steam. But a number of different lines of research have each contributed something towards a result which, in the aggregate, is likely to be very large. Take, for example, the question of nitrogen in agriculture. Here comes a fallacy right off the bat. Everybody knows that all living bodies, whether of plants or animals, contain a certain percentage of nitrogen. Yeah, okay. I guess that's not a fallacy. That's a truth. As a matter of fact, I'll go even one further than that. Every single element on this planet, each of us have animals, humans, and plants. Everything that you can think of, whether it's uranium, gold, silver, whatever the case is. Animals obtain nitrogen only by eating plants or other animals. How do plants obtain nitrogen? This was for a long time a mystery. It seemed natural to suppose that they might obtain it from the air, more particularly from the small amounts of ammonia which it contains. But experiments proved that this was not the case. This conclusion having been arrived at, it remained to discover how plants obtain nitrogen from the soil. This problem was studied by two men, Laws and Gilbert, who throughout a period of 60 years conducted a series of experiments at Rothamsted. Near Harpenden. Wherever those two places are, probably in England. They found that the great majority of plants do not possess the power of fixing nitrogen. In the year 1886, however, Helbrigel and Will Frath found that clover and other luminous plants have a special part to play in the fixation of nitrogen. This was due to nodules in their roots, or rather not to the nodules themselves, but to a certain species of bacteria which lived in the nodules. If the bacteria were absent, these plants were no better than others with regard to fixation of nitrogen. The bacteria, therefore, are the essential agents. It may be said generally, with bacteria alone, so far as we know at present. Sorry, I got an itch here. It may be said generally that bacteria alone, so far as we know at present, have the power, some to transform ammonia into nitrates, and others to utilize atmospheric nitrogen. Ammonia consists of nitrogen and hydrogen, which nitrates consist of nitrogen and oxygen. Certain bacteria in the soil possess the power of getting rid of the hydrogen in ammonia and replacing it by oxygen. The nitrates which they thus produce are capable of nourishing ordinary plants. It is partly in this way, and partly by the means of the bacteria that utilize atmospheric nitrogen, that nitrogen passes from the inanimate world into the life cycle. Until the exploration of Chilean nitrates, this was the only way in which the nitrates required to support life came into being. The nitrates that were used as manure all had an organic origin. The nitrates to be found in Chile and elsewhere are limited in quantity. And if agriculture had to depend upon them alone, it would soon be faced with a crisis through their becoming exhausted. Nowadays, however, the nitrates are artificially manufactured from the nitrogen in the air, a source which is, for all practical purposes, inexhaustible. The amount of nitrate produced in this way is now greatly in excess of that obtained from all other sources. By means of nitrate fertilizers, the food production in a given area can be greatly increased. It is calculated that 1 ton of nitrogen in the form of sulfate of ammonia or nitrate of soda will produce enough food for 34 people for 1 year. It appears as a result of this calculation that, I don't even know what this is, looks like a fancy L, 3. Wish I could see somewhere where he cites what that means. At L3 spent in producing nitrogen fertilizers will add as much to the world's supply of food as L25 spent in bringing new land under cultivation. It follows that at the present time, the production of nitrogen fertilizers is, in general, more profitable in relation to the world's food supply than the opening up of new land by means of railways or irrigation. This example of the application of science to agriculture is interesting because it involves both organic and inorganic chemistry, together with a careful study to the complete life cycle of plants and animals. A very interesting field for scientific research has been opened up in connection with the control of pests. Most pests are either insects or fungi, and in regard to both kinds, much valuable knowledge has been acquired in recent years. The importance of such knowledge is very little realized in the general public, and it is not appreciated by governments except when it can be connected with nationalism. The popular imagination has, it is true, been struck by certain especially noteworthy instances. The control of malaria and yellow fever by preventing the mosquito from breeding has made it possible to render many formerly deadly regions habitable to white men, and in particular was necessary for the construction of the Panama Canal. The connection of the bubonic plague with rats, fleas, and of typhus with lice has also become part of the knowledge of educated people. But apart from such isolated examples, few people, except specialists and certain government officials, realize the existence of vast field of research, which is important in various directions, but especially in relation to the world's food supply. As regards insect pests, some notion as to what has been done and is to be done may be derived from an article in Nature, January 10, 1931, called Entomology and the British Empire. This gives an account of the work of the Third Imperial Entomological Conference and of the Imperial Institute, formerly the Bureau of Entomology. I wonder how many of my readers know that such bodies exist. Yet it appears that on the average 10% of the agriculture produced of the world is destroyed each year by insects. As the above-mentioned article states, it is estimated that in the Indian Empire, for example, the losses in 1921 due to the crop and forest pests alone reached the huge total of, again with the L, 136 million. While the death roll among the population due to insect-borne diseases was stated to be about 1,600,000 persons annually. In Canada, about L, 30 million is lost every year through insect depredations among field and fruit crops and the forest. In South Africa, one pest, the maize stalk borer, incurred losses of about L, 2.75 million in a single year. There are two kinds of methods of controlling insect pests, namely physiochemical methods and biological methods. The former consists usually of fumigation. The latter, which are the more interesting scientifically, consists of the discovery of parasites, which they prey on the destructive insects. On the principle expressed in the rhyme, big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them. Little fleas have smaller fleas, and so on, ad infinitum. In general, in the regions where a pest is indigenous, some parasite exists which keeps its numbers down. But when the pest is accidentally introduced into a new country, the parasite may be left behind, with the result that the pest effects an intensity of destruction quite out of the proportion to what it can achieve at home. Modern improvements in transport have, of course, promoted the spread of noxious insects and have therefore rendered the problem of their control more urgent. These pages are still crisp and hard to turn sometimes, so bear with me, please. Even when there is no question of transference to a new habitat, a great deal can be done, in many cases, by artificial encouragement of useful parasites. Let us take an example of a pest, the danger of which is familiar to everyone who has ever grown tomatoes under glass. I mean the greenhouse white fly. An account of the biological control of this pest is given by Mr. E. R. Speyer in Nature, December 27, 1930. An insect parasite of the white fly called Enchercia formosa was discovered at Elstree in Herbertshire in 1926. And has since been carefully bred at the Chestnut Experimental Station, whence it can be obtained by those who desire it. Throughout the country of Hertfordshire, where the area of cultivation under glass is about equal to that in the whole of the rest of Great Britain. The parasites that have escaped from Cheshunt, C-H-E-S-H-U-N-T. Never seen that word, unless it's misspelled. Cheshunt. Have been sufficiently numerous to reduce the white fly population to a small fraction of what it was 6 years ago. Chug, maybe you can make that call for me, what that word is, and how it sounds. Economic entomology is a subject of great importance, in which the United States is far ahead of the British Empire. Though its potential usefulness in the latter is at least as great as in the former. Such problems as the extermination of the locust and the tsetse fly, which is the cause of sleeping sickness, will probably not be beyond the resources of science in the near future. Fungi are scarcely less harmful as pests than insects. The study of them in England is conducted mainly by the Empirical Mycological Institute at KEW. Which is supported by the Empire Marketing Board. An interesting article on the work of this institute appeared in the Times, February 2, 1931. One of the most familiar and harmful of fungus pests is the disease of wheat called rust. The Canadian government catches the spores of this plant and aeroplanes to discover how it is spread by the wind. Cheshunt, yes, that's how it's spelled. I see. Okay, I guess that makes a little more sense. Thanks, Jug. The importance of the matter to Canada may be judged from the fact that in 1916, at the height of the First World War, black rust destroyed wheat to the value of about L35 million. I wonder if that's lira. I wonder if that's what that's supposed to be. Because it doesn't make any sense from I thought Bertrand Russell was British. So the fancy looking L doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Black rust destroyed wheat to the value of about $35 million in the three prairie provinces alone, and averages in Canada a destruction of about $5 million annually. Potato blight, which is another kind of fungus, caused the Irish famine, and thence led England to adopt free trade in Boston to ban modern literature. These particular diseases This particular disease has now been brought under control, and England is about to abandon free trade. The effect on the fungus on Boston, however, appears to be more permanent. A curious example of the point of contract between different techniques occurred in connection with the construction of aeroplanes. He spells aeroplanes with A-E. A-E-R-O-P-L-A-N-E-S. That's the way a European would spell it. In the modern parts of which the sitka spruce, which grows in British Columbia, is largely employed. As to this, the above-mentioned article in the Times states, a surprisingly large percentage of apparently unblemished timber was at one time found in to break down. No signal of fungi infection could at first be seen, but examination of the institute under a microscope revealed the minute tentacles of a fungus. A Canadian woman worker took up the problem, traveled through the British Columbia forest, and discovered the source of infection of the unfelled timber. Cooperative work between the Forest Products Research Laboratory at Prince Riseborough and its opposite number in Canada showed further that the disease was accentuated by the long voyage through the tropics via the Panama Canal. The trouble has been largely eliminated by a careful examination of trees before they are cut, and by Overlord Transport. Overland Transport. These few examples may serve to show the economic importance of mycology and the science of fungi. Another direction in which biological technique is likely to have great importance before long is scientific breeding. Artificial selection has been applied by man for ages to animals and plants under domestication, and has yielded remarkable results. No wild plant exists on the same species as wheat. The cow, having long been bred for her milk producing qualities, has become very different from any wild animal that ever existed. The racehorse is a highly artificial product, but these results, remarkable as they are, have been produced by methods which can scarcely be called scientific. Nowadays, especially by the means of the Mendelian principles of heredity, there is hope of breeding new varieties of animals and plants in a less haphazard manner. So far, however, what has been attempted in this way gives scarcely more than the suggestion of what may be rendered possible by new discoveries in regard to heredity and embryology. The importance of animals in human life has greatly diminished since the Industrial Revolution. Abraham lived among his flocks and herds. Attila's armies traveled on horses. In the modern world, animals play a very small part as a source of power, and in particular have become quite subordinate as a means of transport. They are still used for food and clothing, but in regard to these also, they will soon be largely superseded. The silkworm is threatened by artificial silk. Real leather will soon be regarded as a luxury for the rich. As yet, wool is still used to make warm clothes, but it is likely that synthetic products will replace it before long. As for meat, it is not a necessary article of diet, and if population continues to increase, we may assume that synthetic beef steaks will be served everywhere except at the tables of millionaires. Interesting. Interesting. Mr. Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab. The cod may survive somewhat longer than the ox for the sake of the vitamins in cod liver oil. But already vitamin D can be generated in the human body by means of artificial sunlight, so that even the cod may not remain necessary for long. Animals have been good friends to man throughout his adolescence. After being dangerous enemies in its infancy. But now that man is becoming an adult, the part played by animals in relation to man is ending, and their future will mainly confide to zoos. One cannot help regretting this, but it is part of the new ruthlessness of man, intoxicated by scientific power. And I guess that's a good place for another break here. This is zipping right along. I don't know. In my opinion, it is anyways. Done with the first hour already. So let me see here. I guess about 6 minute break. Two short songs here, everyone. So be right back. We'll be right back. Okay, and welcome back for the final hour of Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio, PSN Radio, SoFlow Radio, and EPGN Radio. And thanks again for all of the admins and owners of the stations. And once again, we are all listener supported. Please hit that donate button if you can. Well, I don't know about anybody else, but I sent a little message in there right when I went on break. Doesn't everybody think this is zipping along? It does to me, anyways, every week. I read more and more, and new books here and there, and it seems to zip right along. The need for plants will survive longer than the need for animals, because they are as yet essential to the chemical processes upon which human life depends. The use of vegetable products for purposes other than food is not likely difficult to dispense with. It is possible already that to manufacture substances resembling wood in so far as its useful properties are concerned. Though as yet, the process of manufacturing is more expensive than growing the timber. When it becomes cheaper, as it inevitably will, forests will lose their economic value. It is not probable that natural cotton will continue to be used in clothing any more than natural silk. Synthetic rubber will soon replace natural rubber. Almost all such uses of vegetable products, it may be safely assumed, will cease to be important before another 100 years have passed. Food is a more serious matter. It is said to be already possible to manufacture from the air products, which can be eaten and digested. Through dough, there are two objections to them, namely that they are nauseous and expensive. Food can be manufactured from the air products? That doesn't make much sense to me. Never heard of anything like that. I don't know. Both these objections may in time be overcome. The problem of producing synthetic food is purely chemical, and there is no reason to regard it as insoluble. No doubt natural foods will taste better, and rich men at weddings and feasts will provide real peas and beans, which will be mentioned by the newspapers with awe. But in the main, food will be manufactured in vast chemical factories. The fields will fall out of cultivation, and agricultural laborers will be replaced by chemical experts. And coincidentally, or incidentally, he does spell laborers in a European fashion, L-A-B-O-U-R-E-R-S. In such a world, no biological processes will be of interest to man except those that take place in himself. These will be so out of the picture that he will tend more and more to view himself as a manufactured product, and to minimize the share of natural growth in the production of human beings. He will come to value only what is deliberately caused by human agency, not what results from nature's unaided handiwork. Men will acquire power to alter themselves, and will inevitably use this power. What they will make of this, of the species, I do not venture to predict. Chapter 9, Technique in Philosophy. No, Physiology. Sorry. A living body considered as a physiochemical mechanism has some very remarkable properties, which so far no machine... I don't know if I've mentioned this or not. I'll go back and start that over again because my ADHD, but my mind thinks quicker than my mouth does. That's why I think that's the reason why I mispronounce words or miss them totally. A living body considered as a physiochemical mechanism has some very remarkable properties, which so far no machine of human construction can imitate. The physical parts of the mechanism, such as the heart's action in pumping the blood and the working of muscles and bones, are less remarkable than the chemical portions, but have, at any rate, the merit of seldom going seriously out of order. The heart has to work day and night throughout the whole of the man's life, say 70 years. Repairs, well, people didn't even hardly live 70 years back then. What was it, 58 or 62, somewhere in there? Repairs, if any are needed, have to be effected while it is working. An ordinary healthy man is much less often ill than the best of motor cars, in spite of the fact that his engine never gets a rest. The physics of the human body is excellent, but it is less complex and interesting than its chemistry. Is everybody waking, chat? The most remarkable properties of a living body, as opposed to a lifeless one, are nourishment, growth, and predetermination. Nourishment consists in the fact that a living body, by means of various physical apparatus, enters into a chemical contact with suitable foreign bodies and subjects them to a laboratory treatment, which transforms as much of them as possible into substances chemically similar to itself and ejects the useless residue. All right. Thanks, Chuck. I'm glad somebody's awake. Growth consists to the fact by means of cell division and nourishment. The visible complexity of a living body can increase at the same time with its bulk. Predetermination, which is a property of both nourishment and growth, consists in the facts that nourishment is used to keep an adult body nearly unchanging in the structure and chemical composition, while in the youth, growth reproduces within narrow limits the structure of the parents, and thus defined predetermination embraces reproduction and heredity. It seems at first sight an almost mystical property of living matter, but science is gradually coming to understand it, and though as yet far from completely. Okay, yes, it is going fast. Nourishment, the transformation of food into various parts of the body, is a process of quite amazing complexity. Some aspects of it, for example, the operation of vitamins, remain obscure, but the essential characteristics of nourishment is comparatively simple. From the saliva onwards, a series of chemical agents act upon our food until it reaches the condition in which it is fit to enter the bloodstream, out of which the various parts of the body extract what they need, again by means of various chemical agencies. Growth is seen in its most remarkable form, the new fertility ovum, which rapidly divides into two cells, then four, then eight, and so on. While continually increasing in size, growth is capable of assuming morbid forms, for instance, in cancer. Predetermination is exhibited not only in hereditary, but in the ordinary repairs to the wear and tear of the body. When hair and nails are cut, they grow again. When the skin is scratched, new skin forms. When the body has been wasted by illness, it reverts with returning health to very nearly what it was before. Within limits, a living body has the power of restoring itself to its previous structure when it has suffered some not too violent disturbance. Hereditary is an example of the same power. There must be differences between human and simian spermatozoa, corresponding to the differences between men and monkeys. Though the microscope is not sufficiently powerful to reveal them, we must suppose that throughout the growth of the fetus, F-O-E-T-U-S, fetus, a pre-existing complexity is becoming visible, since otherwise the fact of hereditary is unintelligible. The development of the embryo is, therefore, from the standpoint of logic, strictly analogous to the self-preservative quality of the adult body. And it is, of course, true only within similar limits. Technique in physiology is hitherto chiefly taken to the form of medicine in the wildest sense, i.e. the prevention and the cure of disease and death. What has been accomplished in this respect is obvious from the mortality statistics. The changes in the death rate in England and Wales since 1870 have been as follows. 22.9 per thousand. 1929, 13.4 per thousand. In other civilized countries, the changes have been similar. At the same time, owing to another form of technique in physiology, the birth rate has been declining, as the following figure shows. 1870, 35.3 per thousand. In 1929, 16.3 per thousand. There are many consequences to these figures. One is that there is ceasing to be any natural increase of population in civilized countries, and that there may before long be an actual diminution. The other is that there are fewer young people and more old people. Those who believe that the old are wiser than the young will expect good results from this change in the balance between age and youth. On the other hand, it will be regretted by those who feel that. In our rapidly changing world, the old are less likely than the young to understand new forces, and more likely than the young to overestimate decaying forces that are losing their importance. This, however, may be counteracted by a prolongation of physiological youth. Reproduction operated until recently as blindly as a natural force. This, at any rate, was the case among Europeans. Though many savage and barbarous peoples employed various methods of artificial limitation of fertility, during the last 50 years, reproduction among the white races has become increasingly deliberate instead of accidental. As yet, that fact has not produced the political and social consequences that it is bound to entail sooner. Or later. What these consequences are likely to be, we will consider at a later stage. Artificial prevention. Artificial prevention of impregnation is not the only change brought upon by modern technique in this respect, though so far it has been the most important. It is also possible to cause impregnation artificially. Thus far, this process has not been much used. But when it has been perfected, it may be a source of very important changes in connection with eugenics and the family. If it should ever become possible to determine sex at will, there would inevitably be an important readjustment of the relations between men and women. The first effect, one may surmise, will be a considerable excess of male births. This would, and of course, be a generation, confer a scarcity value on women, and introduce overt or surreptitious polyandry. I'm sorry. He split the word up on two different lines. The respect for women would be enhanced by their rarity, with the result that female births would begin to preponderate. In the end, the state would probably have to regulate the matter of the bonus for the sex which was deficient at the moment. These successive oscillations and administrative measures would have bewildering effects upon emotions and morals. It is probably that the most important application of physiological technique in the long run will be to embryology. Hitherto, medicine and even biochemistry have aimed only at health. That is to say, the perfect functioning of a body which had been produced by natural causes. The only method that has been suggested for improving the human stock has been that of eugenics. Heredity. I'm sorry. My eyes are getting a little unfocused, and then they get focused, even with my readers on. Heredity. I had it right first time. Heredity, where the higher animals and man are concerned, is as yet not subject of human control. A given embryo can develop into a healthy or a sickly individual. But if it is to be healthy, it can only be one sort of individual. At any rate, and so far as its heritable characteristics are concerned, mutations occur, but they cannot be produced at will. Yeah, not until now. This, however, is not likely to remain always the case. Exactly. Some, what is it, 80-some years later. There has been much controversy to the inheritance of acquired characteristics, and it seems clear that this does not occur in the form of which Lamarck believed in it. No change in an organism is inherited unless it affects the chromosomes, which are the bearers of hereditary characteristics. but a change which affects the chromosomes may be inherited. When the larvae of a fruit fly are exposed at an early age to the operation of X-rays, they develop into adults which differ noticeably from the most ordinary fruit flies. It may be that the changes produced by X-rays affected the chromosomes as well as the rest of the body, and that, if so, can be inherited. Changes of temperature or of diet may possibly affect the chromosomes. Knowledge of these matters is still in its infancy, but since mutations occur, it is clear that there are agencies which alter the hereditary character of an organism. When these have been discovered, it may be possible to apply them artificially in such a way as to produce some intended result. In that case, eugenics will no longer be the only way of improving a breed. So far, no experiments have been made to test the effects of X-rays on the human embryo. I imagine that such experiments would be illegal, in common with many others that might make valuable additions to our knowledge. Sooner or later, however, probably in Russia, such experiments will be made. If science continues to advance as fast as it has done recently, we may hope, before the end of the present century, to discover ways of beneficially influencing the human embryo, not only as regards those acquired characters which cannot be inherited because they do not affect the chromosomes, but also as regards the chromosomes themselves. It is likely that this result will only be achieved after a number of unsuccessful experiments leading to the birth of idiots or monstrosities. I think I'll take my break right here. So, last break of the show, everyone. Let me see here. I think about another 6-minute break, one single song. So I'll be right back in just a few minutes, everyone.
Well, I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in. Little talk.
Okay, welcome back everyone to about the last 20 minutes or so, I guess, of the show here. 23, 24 minutes, somewhere in there. Don't know how much I will read, but how much I'll be able to read. The brain fog that I'm dealing with. I didn't get to sleep until out 2 o'clock last night, and then I woke up at 6. Go to the bathroom, and then I woke up at about 9. I felt kind of okay this morning, but just started getting tireder and tireder. If that's a word. I don't know if it is. But would this be too high of a price to pay for the discovery of the method by which, within one generation, the whole human race could be rendered intelligent? Perhaps by the suitable choice of chemicals to be injected into the uterus, it may become possible to turn a child into a mathematician, a poet, a biologist, or even a politician. And to ensure that all his posterity shall do likewise, unless prevented by the counter irritant chemicals. The sociological effect of such a possibility is a vast subject, which we will not consider at present. But it would be very rash to deny that some such possibility may exist in the near future. While it is rather rash to make detailed prophecies, it is, I think, fairly clear that in future, a human body, from the moment of conception, will not be regarded merely as something which can be left to grow in accordance with natural forces. That's pretty much the definition of transhumanism. With no human interference beyond what is required for the preservation of health. The tendencies of scientific technique is to cause everything to be regarded as not just a brute datum, but raw material for the carrying out of some human purpose. The child, and even the embryo, will come to be viewed more and more in this way as a mentality, mentality conducted with a scientific technique becomes more dominant. This is, as in other forms of scientific power, there are possibilities of good and possibilities of evil. Science alone will not decide which is to prevail. That's a truth. For sure, right there. Science is not evil. It's the scientist that is evil. Chapter 10, Technique of Psychology. At the point where, when I received what was in those days called an education, psychology was still, to all intents and purposes, the branch of philosophy. Mental events were divided into knowing, willing, and feeling. Attempts were made to define perception and sensation, and in general the subject was one of verbal analysis of concepts that the philosophers had removed familiar, though not intelligible. It is true that every textbook begins with an account of the brain, but having given that account, it may no further. It made no further allusion to it. It is true that it is true also that there existed a form of psychology which made us of laboratories and which made use of laboratories and attempted to be very scientific. This form was practiced especially with Wundt and his disciples. You showed a man a picture of a dog and said, "What's that?" You then measured carefully how long it took him to say "dog." In this way, much valuable information was amassed. But strange to say, in spite of the apparatus of measurement, it turned out that there was nothing to do with this valuable information except to forget it. Every new science is hampered by too slavish an imitation of the technique of some older science. No doubt measurement is the hallmark of an exact science, and therefore scientifically minded psychologists looked about for something measurable connected with their subject matter. They were wrong, however, in thinking that time intervals were the appropriate thing to measure disposition, and as turned out, is occupied by the saliva of dogs. Psychology, as pursued everywhere in the past, was incapable of giving practical control over mental processes, and never aimed at this result. To this general statement, there is, however, one important exception, namely psychology, as studied by the Society of Jesus. Much that the rest of the world has only recently understood was apprehended by Ignatius Loyola and impressed by him upon the order which he founded. The two tendencies which divide progressive psychologists in one day, namely psychoanalysis and behaviorism, are both equally exemplified by Jesuit practice, exemplified in Jesuit practice. I think one may say on the whole of the Jesuits relied mainly on the behaviorism for their own training and upon psychoanalysis for their power over penitents. This, however, is only a matter of degree. The instructions which Loyola gave as regards meditations upon the passion belong rather with the Freudian than with the Watsonian psychology. All modern scientific thinking, as we have already had occasion to remark, is at bottom power thinking. That is to say, the fundamental human impulse to which it appears is the love of power, or is, to express the matter in other terms, the desire of the cause as many and as large effects as possible. Jesuit thinking was, of course, power thinking in a very crude and direct sense. Whereas the true scientific thought, the power impulse, is refined and sublimated. When the Jesuits knew the technique for a given effect, they were no longer concerned with the mechanism by which that effect came about. So as long as the right habits were formed, it was a matter of indifference to them whether they were habits in a larynx. Yeah, I think it's larynx. Or in the adrenal glands. In this respect, remarkable as was their practical understanding, they cannot be regarded as truly scientific psychologists. They practiced an art analogous to that of the horse breaker or the lion tamer. And so long as the art was successful, they were content. The modern psychologist, on the contrary, like Hamlet, must be edified by the margin. For this reason, hypnotism, important and singular as it is, was long ignored by psychologists because they did not know how to fit it in their scheme. For a long time, psychologists did not seem to think that they were called upon to deal with those mental phenomena which could not be regarded as rational, such as dreams, hysteria, insanity, and hypnotism. Man was a rational animal, and the purpose of psychology was to make us think well of him. Strange to say, so long as this view persisted, psychology made no progress. Educational progress came from attempts to teach the feeble-minded, and psychological progress come from attempts to understand lunatics. The feeble-minded, it was admitted, were not necessarily wicked when they failed to learn, and were not therefore to be stimulated by intelligence by flogging. From experience of the feeble-minded, certain persons of transcendent genius arrived at the inference that perhaps the normal intelligence also is not best stimulated by flogging. A similar transformation was brought about the psychology of belief by the study of the insane. The opinions of the insane, it was found, The opinions of the insane, it was found, are not arrived at by a series of syllogisms, having major premises which are universally admitted. But in the 18th century, it was supposed that men of normal intelligence did arrive at their opinions in this way. I do not mean to say that men of normal intelligence supposed this about each other. I mean only that the theoretical psychologists supposed it. When Voltaire's Cacambo is confronted by a horde of cannibals who proceeded to make preparations for eating him, he makes them a set of speech beginning, "Gentlemen," in which he deduces syllogistically from the principles of natural law that they ought only to eat Jesuits, and that since he and Candide are not Jesuits, it would be wrong to roast them. The cannibals find his speech very reasonable and liberate him and Candide with acclamation. Voltaire here is, of course, making fun of the intellectualism of his age. But his age deserved it so far, at least as a theoretical psychologist were concerned. Now, nowadays, though, there is a quite recent development. Theoretical psychologists know as much as mental processes as is known by Jesuits and men of the world. It has been found that the causes of belief is waking life. In waking life are, in the main, analogous to those in dreams, or during insanity, or under hypnotism. They are not, of course, wholly analogous. There is a little leaven of reason which makes all the difference, but the reason is a cause of disbelief rather than of belief. Animal faith supplies what is positive, and reason only what is negative. Science, speaking broadly, is a tree growing from the soil of animal faith, but clipped by the shears of reason. It is the part played by the animal faith that modern psychology has become to understand. There is in psychology two modern techniques which they're as yet more or less antagonistic to each other. There is the technique of Freud and the technique of Pavlov. Freud's purpose was primarily therapeutic. He was concerned to cure people of the less extreme forms of mental disorder. In the course of this attempt, he was led to a view to the causation of such troubles. Freud's theory on this subject has proved even more important than his contribution to therapeutics. I think a free rendering of the general principles emerging from the work of Freud and his followers would be more or less as follows. There are in human beings certain fundamental desires, usually in a greater or less degree, unconscious. And our mental life is molded as so to yield the greatest possible satisfaction of these desires. But however obstacles arise to their realization, the means adopted for overcoming these obstacles are apt to be somewhat foolish in the sense that they operate only in the realm of fantasy. He spells fantasy with PH. That's interesting. I didn't know they did that. And not in that of reality. I do not think that psychoanalysis have reacted very deeply upon the distinction between fantasy and reality. I suppose that practical purposes, fantasy is what the patient believes, and reality is what the analysts believe. Men are not allowed to become recognized analysts until they have become analyzed. And in this process, it is expected that they will adopt the official view as to reality. If they can convey this in turn to their patients, their view of reality will in the end carry the day, or so at least it may be hoped. Without going into metaphysical subtleties, one may say that reality is that which is generally accepted, while fantasy is that which is believed only by an individual or a group of individuals. This definition cannot, of course, be taken strictly, since if it were, the opinion of Copernicus, for example, would have been fantasy in his day and reality in the time of Newton. There are, however, a number of opinions which are quite obviously based upon the individual desires of those who hold them, and not upon grounds which make a universal appeal. It was once visited by a man who expressed a desire to study my philosophy, but confessed that in the only book of mine which he had read, there was only one statement that he could understand, and that was a statement with which he Could not agree. I inquired what the statement was, and he replied, "It is a statement of Julius Caesar is dead." I naturally asked why he did not accept this statement. He drew himself up and replied rather stiffly, "Because I am Julius Caesar." Being alone with him in a flat, I took steps to reach the street as soon as possible, since it appeared to me probable that his opinion was not derived from an objective study of reality. This incident illustrates the difference between sane and insane beliefs. Sane beliefs are those inspired by desires which agree with the desires of other men. Insane beliefs are those inspired by desires which conflict with those of other men. We should all like to be Julius Caesar, but we recognize that if one is Julius Caesar, another is not. Therefore, the man who thinks he is Julius Caesar annoys us, and we regard him as mad. We should all like to be immortal, but one man's immortality does not conflict with another's. Therefore, the man who thinks that he is immortal is not mad. Delusions are those opinions which fail to make the necessary social adjustments, and the purpose of psychoanalysis is to produce the social adjustments which will cause such opinions to be abandoned. The reader, I hope, will have felt that the above account is in some respect inadequate. However hard we may try, it is scarcely possible to escape from the metaphysical conception of fact. Freud himself, for example, when he first propounded his theory of the pervasiveness of sex, was reviewed in the kind of horror that is inspired by a dangerous lunatic. If social adjustment is the test of sanity, he was insane, though when his theories came to be sufficiently accepted to be a source of income, he became sane. This is obviously absurd. Those who agree with Freud must contend that there is objective truth in his theories, not merely that they are such as many people can be got to accept. What remains is a theory of social adjustment to the test of truth, and that beliefs inspired by purely personal desires are seldom true. I mean, by purely personal desires, those that conflict with the interests of others. Take as a illustration the man who becomes rich on the stock exchange. His activities are, it is true, inspired by the desire to become rich, which is purely personal, but his beliefs must be inspired by an impartial survey of the markets. I'm going to turn the page here and see what's going to happen here before I decide if I'm going to go on anymore. Yeah, I think I got a few pages until the end of the chapter here, so I don't know. I think this is a good time to take a break. My brain fog is getting to me still, and I'm getting a little hungry, too. I think I'll mark about a half of a paragraph before so I can go back over it next week. And say thanks for putting up with me, everyone. And see everyone tomorrow, probably. I'm not going to play any song to end. I'm just going to drop the stream. So hope everyone comes out tomorrow for me and Roger's show. See everyone then.